This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle has a lot of empty places of worship and a lot of residents who list their religious affiliation as none. Some churches call this town the Nun Zone. So what are they doing to appeal to the nuns, the skeptics? You're going to hear that in just a few minutes. First, our top story today. What happens now that Seattle's head tax is gone? Just a month after passing the tax unanimously, the city council voted to repeal it and avoid a ballot fight. At City Hall yesterday, Wajamaya President and CEO Denise Moriguchi spoke in favor of that repeal.
Wajamaya has been around for 90 years. It was started by my grandfather. We've been employing people in the Pacific Northwest for 90 years. We've been feeding the community. We donate daily to the ACRS Food Bank. We also support many other organizations that support our communities most vulnerable. I want Seattle to be a vibrant, beautiful city, just like everyone else. I don't want people living in tents as well. I don't want people living on the streets. But this head tax is not the right answer. Taxing businesses, small businesses, businesses that have thin margins that aren't Amazon, will impact prices, will impact jobs, and that's not the right answer. So I want to work together to find real solutions. But this employee head tax is not the answer. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you consider repealing the head tax today.
But Reverend Cecilia Kingman with Edmonds Unitarian Universalist Church told the council not to undo the tax.
In my congregation, we have homeless families sleeping in the parking lot every night. We have children sleeping in the parking lot. This is a sin in such a rich area as ours. And I believe we have a moral imperative to give all our families a home, all our children homes. Housing is a human right. And I demand in the name of the poor and the Poor People's Campaign and all that is holy that you do not only not repeal, but strengthen this plan. Yeah. Councilmember Sawant and Mosqueda for standing up, and shame on the rest of you for caving to corporate interests. I beg you, in the name of all that is holy, in the name of God, in all her names, to do what is just and merciful and right.
And this is Seattle City Councilor Lorena Gonzalez explaining why she voted for the head tax and why she has now voted against it.
There are limited options that we have available to us as a city in terms of generating new revenue that don't require us to further burden homeowners and consumers. And that's why we chose this particular policy. It wasn't because we hate one side more than the other, or that we hate anybody. It's because we have a real crisis in our city. And this was a clear solution to generate the revenue that we needed to be able to meet those needs. And I, like Councilmember O'Brien and Councilmember Herbold, have been unable to find a path forward in which we would be able to outfund and outresource and win this campaign in November. And that saddens me. That saddens me. And sadly, I wish that was true. Somebody from the audience just said that it's not just about money, but it is clear in this case that money has funded this campaign to put us in a situation where we are repealing this law. And that's the truth. That's the truth. And it gives me no pleasure. It gives me no pleasure to have to repeal this law, because I think this law was well done. We pursued a process of 9 months to do outreach, to talk to people, to make concessions that we never wanted to make. And we made those concessions because we felt that the urgency of now to address the reality that people are dying on our streets needed to be addressed. And it still does. You're absolutely right. It still does. That is the challenge before us. And we will continue on this city council to fight for solutions that make sense, that will not tear our city apart, and that will help us save the lives that we all know that we need to save.
Those are some of the voices from yesterday's emotional, as you heard, city council hearing in which the city decided to repeal that head tax that it unanimously passed just about a month ago. Now, one of the original sponsors of the head tax, City Councilor Mike O'Brien, faced some of the harshest backlash from the community.
You know, what this has proven is that various components of our community have the power to stop things. And what we need people to come together to actually solve things.
Actually solve things. Okay, so what solutions are there? Let's turn to local businesses that opposed the tax, including one that specializes in housing. Glenn Kelman is the CEO of the real estate brokerage Redfin. They came out against the tax, but they did not sign the business community's petition to repeal it. Glenn, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
Saul Spady is the grandson of the co-founder of Dick's Drive-In Restaurants. He led the No Tax on Jobs campaign. However, he's not here representing them today. He also runs the ad agency Creative Empowerment in Seattle. Saul, welcome to KUOW.
Great to join you and have this tough conversation.
You both, a tough conversation. Well, let's have it. Both of you disliked the head tax, at least. The city council reversed it. You won that round. So, Glenn, what is your role now? You just heard Councilmember O'Brien talk about solutions. What is your role in the solution to affordability or homelessness as a Seattle business CEO?
Well, first, to be clear, we did not favor overturning the city council's head tax once it passed. We did say originally that when it was being discussed that we would prefer a different form of tax. We think you should tax revenue or income. There are other ways to tax businesses. The reason that we didn't sign the letter that almost every other business in Seattle signed against the head tax is because we have put the city in a position where it's very hard to raise revenue. You can't tax income because of a state constitution. And then we've opposed efforts to change that in 2010 and more recently in 2016. So our plea to the business community has been not to go in favor of a head tax, which tends to tax employment and favors businesses that use contractors instead, but to support a tax on income or to support a tax on revenue. They're just lots of ways that we can fund homeless programs. And our other position has been that you need to zone for more density.
Yes, because as you say, the income tax doesn't exist. That would take a change in state law. The voters have overwhelmingly defeated that. Now the head tax is repealed. So your favorite solution is a change in zoning. And will you briefly tell us why that is?
Well, the city can never build enough housing on its own. And if you talk to any builder in the city, they want to create much larger buildings, and most neighborhoods in Seattle aren't zoned for that kind of density. You take very liberal people who are very supportive of homeless populations and other programs like that, and they go crazy when somebody tries to build a condominium tower in their neighborhood because it puts your house in shade, because it creates more traffic and things like that. But the only alternative is a very expensive city. Any city spending will be a drop in the bucket if we don't build more housing.
Okay, Glenn, so then you didn't like the option of a head tax. You prefer an income tax, but that doesn't exist.
A tax on revenue.
Or a tax on revenue, which is not happening now. So one could say that those business sacrifices are not happening, and you're suggesting what, as you just described, would be a sacrifice to homeowners who don't want apartments next to them. They like their neighborhood the way it is. So what is the sacrifice that Redfin, that's realistic, that's a real thing, what is your responsibility now toward the issue of affordability or homelessness?
To call every business leader we know and say that we have to be very clear about the kind of tax we would support, and to say openly and aggressively that we're willing to pay more taxes to solve this problem.
Okay, calling business owners. Saul, you're a business owner, Saul Spady. Is there a tax that you would support for affordability for homeless services?
You know, and I think this is actually a perfect conversation because it's everything that we're going to have to go through in Seattle. Glenn and I don't see perfectly eye to eye, but there's things that we can connect on. I have a problem with how much the city is spending. Our budget's ballooned about $2 billion in the last 4 years. And I think there is a reasonable argument to say that the city could spend more effectively. Where I think Glenn has nailed it, though, is the concept that people want to build more. And I think it's unfair to say that it's either business owners making sacrifices or homeowners making sacrifices. Business owners are quite often homeowners sometimes, and vice versa.
But we have to be willing to make sacrifices. We have to be willing to pay more taxes. Are you willing to do that?
I've got a really small business.
I think the answer is
plan,
no.
So, Glenn, I've got a super small business, so my margins are pretty low. But I appreciate your perspective. I would love to talk to you about the idea of zoning within a half mile, let's say, of light rail for high-density dorm-style buildings where you don't have to build parking for people like myself who don't own cars. For example, Nikita Oliver really nailed it in the last election. She pointed out how the city owns a ton of land, and you similarly said that the city can't personally build its way out of it. So maybe we could take Nikita Oliver's idea of using city land. We could do what the current council has done with the Key Arena and allow those developers who do want to build the option of, let's say, building 10 stories. And that's just an example. We can obviously get into the nitty gritty, you know, 10 stories of dorm style housing where they have to give the bottom two stories to a service provider, a la what Amazon did, building 200 units into the bottom of one of their new buildings.
Okay, Saul, that's a suggestion. I want to, when we're talking about what your what the business role is, what your role would be, I don't hear that you're in support of any new tax. You said the city has enough money and should spend it more effectively. So what should the city stop spending on in order to shift that money toward affordability and homelessness services? What should the city not do?
I guess I'd like the city can partner with the business community, that we have this mix of it's either the city building housing or no one's building housing is really confusing to me. When Amazon offered to build that dorm-style housing, co-housing into its building, the mayor at the time, not our current mayor, had to allow that. He created a special zoning exception for that. It isn't against the realm of reason for the city to provide avenues for developers to help build our way out of this. The one thing the city is not going to get is a developer isn't going to build a building that they can't make money on. Similarly, I would assume Redfin would never build a house that they can't make a profit on or sell a house they can't make a profit on. But I understand.
Glenn, you've said that the goal of all government and economic policy should be to maximize, not penalize, employment. What if citizens decide that maximizing employment diminishes their quality of life? They don't like the price increases, the traffic, the construction, the homelessness that they may connect to price increases. They don't want the upzoning of single-family neighborhoods. So is that the goal of all government economic policy, to maximize employment, if the citizens are saying we want something different?
Well, there's obviously room for disagreement, but I think that should be the top priority. I've seen the city of San Francisco, where I lived before coming back home to Seattle, stick its head in the sand, oppose every kind of growth initiative, and it basically became a place where only millionaires could live. And so the reason that we've tried so hard as a business to talk about the taxes that we would be not only willing but eager to pay, to talk about different ways that we can try to reach across to all the other parties in this discussion, is because we've seen what happens when we just try to say no to prosperity. You stick your head in the sand and you get a city that nobody wants. No one in the city of San Francisco is happy with how things have turned out there, where the average home costs more than $1 million, where Google buses are being pelted with eggs, where homeless people are suffering on the same street that Twitter and Dropbox are located. It's just a tragedy. And so because we've seen that, we really tried to take this very aggressive position about saying, I wouldn't tax employment. There are so many businesses right now that don't pay a living wage, that try to use contractors, where the janitor can never get the corner office, where the Uber driver never gets a career, never gets a salary, never gets health care benefits. You don't want to punish the businesses that are employing people, but you do want to ask those businesses to pay a tax based on their ability to pay, based on their revenues, based on their income. That's just the difference. As a CEO, my goal is to drive the mission of the company, but also to drive profit.
Okay.
And that's different than government policy, which should be to drive employment, to get people jobs.
Saul, you are a former board member of Mary's Place. You started No Child Sleeps Outside campaign, raising money for Mary's Place. What are you concretely doing next? Now that this head tax is repealed, what are you doing and what are you giving when it comes to alleviating social ills in Seattle?
Well, and I'd like to just point out, my business is very different from Redfin. So I'm an extremely small business. I gross less than $300,000 a year. For me, it isn't about what I can give with money. It's about what I can give with time. So with the No Child Sleeps Outside campaign, that was a commitment that we needed more family homeless emergency shelter as soon as possible. And I committed my energy to trying to raise that money with the organization I thought that was most effective. What I would ask every business, Redfin included, is to try to find, you know, if you want to pay more taxes, you're more than welcome to send in more money to the city government, but also find a charity in Seattle that you'd love to partner with. One of my favorites in the city that I wish the city, and again, I would love to see the city partner with businesses and with charities to do effective work, is the Millionaires Club. A majority of the people at Safeco Field are coming out of a slightly homeless lifestyle, working concessions, you know, and they got placed there with the Millionaires Club. How cool would it be if we had a business-funded program between unions, Amazon, Redfin, that funded a trash pickup team of former homeless people who would then get connected with services and then get connected with those bottom floors of dorm-style housing and then could choose their career and choose their union and or, you know, go into restaurants if they like that and work with Fair Start. I guess I understand.
Glenn, do you want to join that team?
Well, we have. We support Recovery Cafe and things like that. And I want to be clear that I don't want to accuse anyone of having bad intentions. We all want to solve the problem. We really do. And the challenge that I have with some of the ideologues is this assignment of malice to someone on the left or the right. But where we disagree is that when we as a society collectively decide to solve a problem, the way we do that is by funding it through taxes. And I'm not saying that that's the only solution. I do think that zoning and other regulations can create more housing. But I would love to see the business community, and especially the tech community, reach across the aisle, even when it hurts, to try to avoid the schism that I saw in San Francisco. I'm begging you to do that because the loss of trust, the lack of dialogue is so deadly.
That's really frustrating, Glenn, because I've spent a lot of time having conversations with people who don't necessarily agree with me, trying to do the exact same thing.
I don't know if you
watched the city council yesterday, but there was a lot of blame being placed on the citizens. And I think that's a little unfair that the spending has increased massively. There is a point where you can sometimes ask for accountability on dollars. Literally, I've talked with union members, with small business owners and large business owners. We all understand what it means to set a budget and meet it. This council literally laughs at us when we ask for that. And that isn't an unfair thing to ask for, along with, you know, changing zoning, along with businesses like Amazon, let's say, building housing into their buildings. There's no one in San Francisco that's built, you know, 200, that is building 200 shelter units into their building. We have bottom floor retail that's empty all over the city because no one can afford it. Why don't we provide tax incentives to give that bottom floor retail away? It doesn't always have to be taxed. That's where I get
I'm not frustrated, but I'm just curious
why we can't do some of these other things I've mentioned, and it has to be more taxes.
Okay, guys.
I'm just saying that it has to be all three. It has to be businesses taking leadership, government getting efficient, better regulations around zoning, and more funding.
Glenn,
the most likely outcome is that there will be more homelessness next year.
Glenn and Saul, that's our time for the segment for now. We are putting the pause on the blame and the malice that you described and trying to figure out what solutions we can agree on even from different points of view. So I really appreciate that. Glenn Kelman, CEO of Redfin, Saul Spady, who runs the ad agency Creative Empowerment in Seattle, led the No Tax on Jobs campaign, not representing them today, representing himself. Thanks to the both of you for this time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. You can feel the emotion and the hope for a better day in the city. We're going to keep bringing together people from different points of view as we cover the issues of taxes, employment, growth, and affordability and homelessness in this city. More with The Record coming up. Stay tuned. KUOW's The Record. Did you know that Seattle has the second most places of worship per capita in the nation? That's according to a property research company. But meanwhile, we're also the second most religiously unaffiliated city in America. So basically, Seattle's got a lot of empty churches. And after June 24th, there'll be one more, as that's the last day of service for the Capitol Hill Presbyterian Church. And here to discuss why Seattle is leaving its places of worship empty in some cases are Reverend Eliana Maxim with the Seattle Presbytery. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you.
Also, Jeff Kuz, a professor of Christian Ministry, Theology, and Culture, Seattle Pacific University. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Tyler Gorsline, pastor at a Seattle church. That's the name, a Seattle church.
That's the name.
So if you're searching online for a Seattle church, yours pops right up.
That's right.
Good to have you. So as I said, a lot of Seattleites list their religious affiliation as none. Eliana, you call these people the nuns.
Well, that's the label that's been given to this area for many years.
Yes.
We were just speaking that it's not really reflective of who we have become.
What do you mean?
I think the assignation of people in Seattle or the Pacific Northwest as being uninterested or not participatory of the spiritual life is incorrect. I think people have a real deep hunger for spirituality.
How do you know that that's true?
We can tell by the people who come and visit churches, the people that are involved in parachurches activities and other spiritual outlets. I think what is not changed is the way we start churches and what churches think that they're supposed to be serving the communities. And so I think that's for our denomination as the Presbyterian Church USA is trying to figure out is what is the church that we need to become in order to serve the changing landscape of people's spiritual desire. And we're finding out that it's not just come to a place on Sunday morning and worship. It's a place where there is spiritual development, but there's also the practice of being spiritual.
Well, then, is it asking the wrong question to about how we get Seattleites into places of worship? Or as my friend who worked for the Catholic diocese put it, how do we put butts in pews, she used to say. Tyler, is that a legitimate question to ask?
Well, it's one thing to note that people are asking why church, you know, anymore. What's the point? You know, you mentioned our name. The reason for us being a Seattle church is we want to partner with people in the city who are already doing really great things that aren't necessarily in the building or, you know, that are outside of the walls. And so a big part of our heart is to do that, is to meet people where they are doing what they care about already, you know, to help people find jobs because they're already really passionate about finding a job in the city, mm-hmm. or serving in the ways that they already do with, you know, our local homeless population or fellow entrepreneurs, things like that. And so we realize that going where people are and fanning the flame of their passion is really important.
Jeff, was it you who was suggesting that churches start a coffee shop, for example?
Well, it's certainly been one of the pathways that many congregations have chosen to do to try to attract new people. I'm an executive director as well of a five-year longitudinal study. It's a $1.5 million grant from the Lilly Foundation to study religious affiliation in the Pacific Northwest. And we've just finished our first data collection cycle in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And one of the things we found is that of the 11 factors that 23 to 29-year-olds are looking for, they see that churches are doing a really good job in spiritual growth, but they don't want the spiritual growth that's being offered. And one of the things we're finding in our study is 20-year-olds are looking for a move away from what they're calling people who are allies to advocates, meaning as opposed to saying, hey, we really believe in what you're doing, but then they don't act on it, too. We want to see you act on it. So coffee shops may be one thing, but we're seeing a lot more of how do we kind of truly become involved in Black Lives Matter. How do we align with, gay pride parades? How do we really show as a church that we really are the flesh and bones of belief that people are saying makes us human?
You're bringing up some political questions. I want to talk about how far politics goes. For example, we asked on Facebook what was stopping our listeners from going to a place of worship. And Celia said, I showed up the Sunday after the election looking for solace and sat in a room with people crying and lost, and the pastor completely whiffed it. At that point, my trust was lost, and I was mad I wasn't in bed or eating waffles somewhere. So I don't know what that pastor said or didn't say, but Eliana, do you talk presidential politics in church, and do you want to?
Well, you know, that's really is the prerogative of each pastor. But the reality is it's not radical for us to be political as Christians. I always think it's interesting when people want us to talk about Christ and yet not talk about politics when Christ was so political himself. I really want to go back to some of the things that Tyler and Jeff alluded to, this whole butts in the seat thing.
Butts in pews, as my friend said.
Yeah. We need to get over that. Mm-hmm. That was such an industrial age motif of what it meant to be church. And in some ways, what we're doing is we're going back to what it meant to be the early church, the beginning of church, which was not creating edifices in which to gather large numbers of people, but it was the actual engaging with communities, going out into the community and being church to people.
Does that involve proselytizing, or is that the proper word? Is that considered a slur anymore? Proselytizing.
Well, it's certainly, if you think of it more as are you doing what you say you believe? If that's proselytizing, then churches need to do more of it. If it is, I want you to convert to who I am, but not take seriously who you are, then that's a problem. And I think too often there's been a tradition in Christianity of conversion as opposed to community. We want to convert you to who we are and leave behind who you've always been. One of the distinctive parts, really, since the founding of Christianity under Christ has been that diversity is the mark of what it means to be in community, not homogeneity. And some of that gets lost through time as the industrial complex, as Eliana puts it, has become more and more the model. We see more and more congregations are struggling around, how do I keep pensions for my pastor in play, which is money, and how do I keep my building open, which is money. And if that's the primary driver, not the reason, the mission and the vision for your institution, then you lose a lot of sight around those questions.
Well, as it relates to proselytizing, Tyler, you were describing dinners all summer long coming up in South Lake Union this summer, but not so much the Bible discussion, right?
So, it's interesting to go back to your earlier question. So, you know, after the election happens, we have people all across the spectrum in our community in terms of, very strong opinions on each side of that because we have a diversity. And so, we just sat in the mess together and let people share and talk. And so this summer, it's actually going to be, 11:15, we're doing lunches, we're doing our gathering, but our gathering is going to be a place where people can actually talk and share from where they are with one another, in concert with community organizations. Friends from Compass and Mary's Place are going to come out and, be served a meal as well as help serve. We think that's how Jesus came, was to serve, not to be served. And as Dr. Cuse mentioned, that the model historically has been, let's go to the city to get from the city. And we're not interested in that. Our goal is to come to serve the city and to be a place of hope and light through interacting, with our local coffee shop, who will be serving cold brew while we hang out with our neighbors and have conversations, and with the Denny Park Foundation and with Seattle Parks, who are letting us rent the park to do these things. We just want to.
But whether you're Christian or any religion, does it involve in Seattle? Do you have to downplay the religious part?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay,
I think sincerely, people are running from fundamentalism when they come to Seattle. Seattle is a place where people can have freedom to pursue their spiritual questions. And I think that's really beautiful in many other places where you're told it's either this or that. And we desire to point people towards Jesus because that's what we believe. However, we want people to be able to belong before they become anything and actually have a place where they can reside and have community first.
Earlier in the show, we played audio from the city council hearing on the head tax repeal, and one of the speakers, Cecilia Kingman, spoke from a religious point of view.
In my congregation, we have homeless families sleeping in the parking lot every night. We have children sleeping in the parking lot. This is a sin in such a rich area as ours, and I believe we have a moral imperative to give all our families a home. I beg you, in the name of all that is holy, in the name of God, in all her names, to do what is just and merciful and right.
Do you all believe that every place of worship has a moral responsibility to provide homeless people food, shelter, counsel?
So much of what you see in the entirety of the canon of scripture that Christians bind as authoritative to them is land and the place that land plays, that is given to us to be good stewards of, not to be dominant over. So I do think it's a moral and a moral issue and a sign of integrity.
And what about religious tough love, the God helps those who help themselves?
Well, you know, that leans more into Benjamin Franklin than it does actually
I never saw that in the Bible.
But people will quote that as if it is. There's more about the, you know, the Good Samaritan and how do we walk alongside those who are a neighbor from Leviticus 19. So,
and the Great Commandment. I mean, as Christians, it boils down to the Great Commandment. Love God, love your neighbor, period. No qualifications and no categorizations. You know, I think one of the things that I think is really important to bring up is that there are some churches in Seattle that are thriving. They're doing well, houses of worship, Christian, Muslim, Jewish. And I think a common denominator you'll find with them that they're doing well is that they're engaged with their community. They understand their neighborhood. They are engaged. They're part of the fabric of that community. The proselytizing, that comes secondary. That becomes out of your actions. It flows out of your relationships.
Okay. Thank you. Professor, what makes you hopeful when you look at religious life in Seattle now?
Well, just like Ileana and Tyler have said, there's just so much evidence that people are gathering together with purpose and meaning. We see over and over new churches that are starting. Ileana represents just one denomination among many in our region that are trying and experimenting with new innovations. The grant that I'm with is giving money away to congregations to try new things, and they're trying great experiments. They're creating WeWork spaces. They're creating homeless shelters. They're creating places for single mothers to find refuge after domestic abuse. And these are actions that people are responding to in their communities that's deeply, deeply part of what Seattle has always been about. I mean, this is a city that has been formed and framed by people who are deeply concerned with their environment, deeply concerned with neighborliness, deeply concerned with economic justice. And the more that people lean into the very sinew of what it is to be in the Pacific Northwest, the more these churches thrive.
Tyler, that's the end of our time, so I'll just have to take your nodding as an amen.
Amen.
On that, yes. Tyler Gorslein, co-founding pastor at a Seattle church. Jeff Kuz, professor of Christian ministry, theology, and culture at Seattle Pacific University. Reverend Ileana Maxim, associate executive presbyter Seattle Presbytery.
That's it.
Thank you to all of you for talking about worship and faith and community in Seattle. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More of The Record coming up. Thanks for listening to and supporting KUOW. Did you hear the big news out of Russia this morning?
The member associations of Canada, Mexico, and USA have been selected by the FIFA Congress to host the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Thank you.
So we'll find out in a couple of years which American cities will get to host World Cup games. Seattle is in the running. Century League Field is on the short list. And soccer journalist Roger Bennett says the odds are good.
When you look at that atmosphere on a television set, a Seattle Sounders home game, you cannot help but want to dive through the television set and just be there.
Yes, soccer is popular in Seattle. The Sounders play to sold-out crowds. But what about the rest of this country? You know, soccer's been called America's game of the future since I started playing it in the early 1970s. Well, Roger Bennett argues that the future is here. He co-hosts the NBC sports show and the podcast Men in Blazers. And Roger says America has become a soccer country. It's just been building to that ever since the World Cup in 1994, when Americans definitely did not care as much about soccer as we do now.
I mean, to be honest, I was just thrilled that the sport had any bearing whatsoever. You couldn't find it on television really before the 1994 World Cup. But World Cup to World Cup, 2002, 2006, every World Cup has grown the audience. And there was just a Gallup study of Americans and their sporting fandom. And they realized that for those under the age of 34 in America, soccer is the third favorite biggest sport in this country at 11%, which is remarkable. I mean, towers over baseball at 6%. It's a huge number when you know how much of the 330 million that 11% actually represents. And America is a true soccer nation.
You've said that America needs to lose the suburban mentality we have around soccer.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mentality. Before the last World Cup, I did a study with a Princeton academic called Greg Kaplan, where we looked at the socioeconomic backgrounds of every U.S. men's national team footballer from 1990, when they first qualified for the first time in 40 years for the World Cup, to 2014. And then we compared them to the Pro Bowlers and the NBA All-Stars, who are kind of, I guess, the closest equivalent we have in the NFL and basketball to the best of the best of the American athletes. And soccer players just skewed off the charts in terms of economic background, socioeconomic background. The zip codes they hail from were some of the most affluent in America. And soccer, successful soccer in almost every country in the world, it's a working class game. You know, there's a hunger, a desire to succeed. I can count the number of elite middle class players on two hands. Most of the players are like Wayne Rooney, who kind of grew up fighting on the football field to define himself and grab an aspirational kind of name that would not have been open to him outside of the game. And in America, we have an unbelievably rich, fertile youth program up and down the West Coast in particular. You know, the Latino footballer, the tenacity that exists there. The US soccer system is just not set up to engage it, identify it, develop it. We had the Mexican national team coach on our show, Men in Blazers, a gentleman called Juan Carlos Osorio. And he said with a laugh, he said, the honest truth is, we know where the best Mexican-American talent is, far better than US soccer currently. And he was being honest, it's a big problem. I know US soccer are aware of it. And it's something that in the next decade, we need to work on.
How, you mentioned the US national team. They didn't even qualify for the World Cup. How surprised were you?
On a scale of zero, not surprised, to 10, I was about 1,000. It was a shocking atrocity, a mix of bad leadership, overconfidence, some hubris, some nemesis, some just bloody awful football. We needed to draw against Trinidad and Tobago in the final game of World Cup qualifying, TNT being the single worst team left in the tournament. It was like magical realism watching these elite professional footballers stumble around this field in Trinidad and Tobago, knowing they needed just one goal in 45 minutes, something that should never have been beyond them. Yet their legs felt weighed down like lead. The American jerseys, you could see, weighed as much as chainmail. There's many nations that have not qualified for the World Cup, this World Cup. Italy, a world power, did not qualify. Chile, the Netherlands did not qualify. Of course, for America, they're not just trying to win games. They're still trying to grow the game, the American game in this country. So while their absence will really be felt, the World Cup will still be magical. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, Bill, England did not qualify for two World Cups in my youth, 1978 and 1994. And they were the two greatest World Cups of my childhood because I could watch just with eyes open, just reveling in every storyline without having to kind of fear the doom of my beloved England because they weren't in it anymore. I was kind of freed from that sporting sword of Damocles hanging over my head, and I could just dive in, immerse myself and savor it. And I think that's what every American is going to do during Russia 2018.
I hadn't thought of it that way. So as we're watching without the sword of Damocles, who should Americans, besides England, of course,
don't do England, Bill. Don't do England. No. It's like rubbernecking at NASCAR races, just waiting for the crash. Anyone but England.
We love a good underdog story. It's not the Americans. It's not the English now. So who should we root for?
Well, Seattle has a number of players of their own, their nearest and dearest. going into World Cup action. Ramon Torres playing for Panama. Gustav Svensson was named in Sweden's 23-man roster. So you could start there. I mean, there's so many remarkable storylines. And I always say, don't choose a team. Let that team just jump out in the opening round and choose you with their heart, their soul, their tenacity, the joy with which they take the field. I'm fascinated and have been for a long time since I first went there a couple of years ago with the Icelandic national team. This tiny nation of 325,000 people in Corpus Christi, Texas, is roughly the same size. They have 20,000 registered soccer players on that island. Rhode Island actually has more. And yet they have worked out with a blueprint, with a tactical plan, how to invest in their nation's athletes to produce a stream of elite footballers. They've invested heavily, heavily in phenomenal coaching, and it has paid off. And then some. They have this team where it's almost starless, the team, but the collective tenacity with which they take the field. They truly believe, when you interview them, Bill, that Viking blood runs through their veins. Their manager is a part-time dentist, a friend of mine, Jaime Halmagrisson. And they are going to, 12 years ago, he was coaching his local under 12 team, In a couple of days' time, he's going to walk out onto the field leading his team against Messi and Argentina. And I'll tell you, they fancy their chances. And there's something when I watch Iceland play with a collective tenacity, with a just superb self-confidence and belief in each other, that reminds me of the US team in 1994 when they took to the World Cup field. So I admire them greatly, and I hope it's a kind of spirit that US soccer can reconjure in years to come.
All right, go Vikings. Roger Bennett, anything you want to leave us with as we head into another World Cup?
Well, when the World Cup, which I've got to say, I have been waiting for it. It is just 4 years, but it feels like 40. When it kicks off tomorrow, it's 32 days of nations just colliding, fighting out, relitigating their histories, wars, conflicts, new heroes will be forged, villains just derided, names we'd never heard of from kind of Iran or Nigeria or Japan will become global heroes just because of feats that they perform with the world watching. And that's the World Cup. Americans in 1990 did not care that their team had even qualified for this tournament. This nation, even though their national team, America, will not be in the World Cup, will be watching. It's the biggest circus. Americans adore a circus. And they also, more than any other nation I've ever lived in, Bill, they adore the opportunity to daytime drink, to cut work, to charge from the office cubicle, head to bars for 32 days, Seattle. You don't need permission from your boss. Take it from Bill. Right, Bill? You are allowed to cut work, head to the bar and just revel in what the rest of the world is reveling in, which is just World Cup fever.
As long as you make a pledge to your public radio station, you can have the day off. I decree it in Seattle.
That's a fair trade.
Roger Bennett is the co-host of Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network and co-author of the new book, Encyclopedia Blazertanica, A Suboptimal Guide to Soccer, America's Sport of the Future Since 1972. He's also the host of a new podcast, American Fiasco, about America's disastrous World Cup journey between 94 and 98. Roger and his co-author Michael Davies in Seattle Saturday the 16th at the Showbox Soto. Roger, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Bill. And Seattle, courage.
The courage. The 2018 World Cup begins tomorrow morning. Russia plays Saudi Arabia. It'll be another 2 years until we find out whether Seattle will host a World Cup match in 2026, whether the Vuvuzelas will honk at CenturyLink Field.